Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, Simon explains why the FTSE has been hitting record highs this week. Does it mean the UK stock market is finally about to shine? Meanwhile, Tanya helps us work out what makes a good retirement investment. Plus, she's a state pension top-ups update on some of the cases that she's been following of late. Also today, inheritance tax hits another record. The probate debacle continues. And are you a backseat driver without even knowing it? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy, cost effective, and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, this week we notched up not one, not two, but three record highs for the FTSE 100. But cares? Over in the US, they see this all the time. And despite all the fuss over here, the UK stock market remains deeply unloved by global investors. But, and we've been saying this for ages now, but could that all be about to change? Tanya, Simon, welcome. Simon, what's been going on with the FTSE?
Well, the FTSE 100, the leading UK stock market index, which doesn't lead the world in terms of gains over the long term, has been putting in a series of record highs this week. Now, we tend to have to wait quite a while for record highs in this country, but they've come along like buses. We've had not one, not two, but three record highs this week. And as we record this podcast, the FTSE 100 is up again on Friday. So quite the run of stuff. What's happened is that the FTSE has notched up these closing highs of 8023.9 on Monday, 8044.8 on Tuesday, 8078.9 on Thursday. These all beat the previous record close of 8.014 on the 20th of February 2023. The backstory to this, though, is more than having to wait just over a year for a record high. The backstory is that after the dot-com bust, when the FTSE 100 closed at a peak of 6930.2 on the 31st of December 1999, just as investors were downing tools and waiting to party like it really was 1999, it hit a high and then it never regained that peak until February 2015. 15 long years we waited to recapture that FTSE 100 high. There were a few close calls. There was a bit of excitement. Is it going to do it? Is it going to do it? Nope. Is it going to do it? Is it going to do it? Nope. People just sort of given up. And what this means is that when you look at the long-term return of the FTSE 100, the really long-term return, the go all the way back to where it finished in the 1990s, it doesn't look that great. It was up on Wednesday before it put in another high yesterday when I did these figures. It was up by a mere 16%. 16% in 25 years. But it's not the full story, because stock market indices based on share prices don't really tell you what you get from investing, because you need to take into account share price performance and also the dividends that are paid out by the companies within it. Now, if you factor those in, things start to look a hell of a lot better for the FTSE. So the FTSE 100, including dividends, is actually more like about 160% up since the start of the 2000s. That's a much better return. It's still not the kind of return you've had from the US stock market. It's still not the kind of return you've had from the global stock market, but it is considerably better. So this is the kind of backdrop to all of this. It's now been putting in record highs. And the thing that drove it to a record high yesterday was another takeover bid for a UK company, except this time it's a ginormous one.
What's the significance of that, Simon?
Well, this is a mining giant, BHP, which is actually an Australian company, although it has a dual listing. So it has a listing on the UK stock market, but also in Sydney. Its main listing is in Sydney. And it wants to take over Anglo American, which is a UK mining company. And it would create a global mega miner. Mega miner? Miner major? I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
I like the sound of that, yep.
Yeah. Okay, £31 billion this takeover is. And Anglo has said, no thanks, you're undervaluing us and you're undervaluing our prospects. And investors in the city have said, no, we think this is too cheap. I mean, it was at a premium to the Anglo-American share price, and it drove up the Anglo-American share price substantially, which in turn helped lift the market. But what also helped lift the market is investors now going, well, hang on a minute, who else is a target? There's even been talk, for example, of something like BP or Unilever becoming a target. And what's interesting is that the FTSE 100, and actually just the UK stock market, the FTSE 100 is not a measure of the UK stock market. The FTSE All Share is the better measure of the UK stock market because it includes the 100 and the 250 and some of the smaller companies below that. The 250 is much more domestically focused. The 100 is full of like big global companies that tend to make most of their money around the world. But it's what we use as our barometer. It's what we use as our proxy for the UK stock market. Investors just aren't that interested in backing those companies. They see better opportunities elsewhere, largely in America, which totally dominates the global stock market. It makes up more than 60% of the global stock market at the moment, whereas the UK makes up about 4%. The UK stock market is about as big as Apple. So people just aren't that interested because they're more interested in just buying Apple than they are in buying the whole UK stock market. But what that means is when you compare it on valuation measures like price to earnings, price to book, the dividend yield that you get and various things like that, it does look comparatively cheap. And the argument is if you don't buy it, other people will. And the other people who are the global companies coming in and snapping up UK companies. And we had another one today, which is a UK cybersecurity star, Darktrace, which is one of our few tech firms. That's also the subject of a takeover bid. And what's interesting about the Anglo-American thing and the timing of it is that one of the UK's most famous fund managers, Nick Train, in an interview with Financial News this week, said that he thinks that the catalyst, you know, that finally gives the UK stock market the boot up the backside that it needs or gets investors interested, might be some kind of really big takeover. Now, is it a really big takeover attempt or a really big takeover that actually goes through? Who knows? But, you know, maybe we've just seen that catalyst. Maybe he just made an extremely prophetic comment in that interview. Maybe we haven't. Maybe it's another false dawn. Or maybe we need it to be a household name company because, you know, Anglo-American, there aren't going to be that many British people you stop in the street and say, so what do you think of this Anglo-American bid? And they're going to know what on earth you were talking about. But I guarantee you, if somebody tries to take over BP or Unilever, then you're going to hear about it.
Daniel is an investing expert. What is your take on all this? What's been the problem with the UK stock market as well?
I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with the stock market, but as Simon put it in his column, investors just aren't fussed with it for the reasons that he's explained. You have to, I suppose, look at the fact that America's got lots of tech stocks, which seem quite exciting, and looking to the future. And the FTSE is dominated by commodity stocks and banks and other financial stocks. And these things go in and out of fashion. And at various points, they might come back into fashion. But stock market investing, it is about looking to the future. So you can kind of see, just on a vibes basis, why tech stocks are so popular. Whether you think of the rights and wrongs of Brexit, I think it is also the case that that is one of the reasons that international investors lost interest a bit. They may be right or they may be wrong, but I think they see us as a bit of more of a backwater now. But the very fact that we're cheap should drive interest. It hasn't so far. I mean, experts have been saying the UK's cheap for absolute years and it hasn't yet made us more popular. One of the things that I think is driving it at the moment also is you've got to look at currency effects. And this is all about the endless interest rate speculation. The dollar's been a bit stronger over the past week. Actually, it's gone off a bit in the last couple of days. But it was, if you look at the past month, it's been a bit stronger. And that's because people are now thinking that interest rates in the US are going to stay higher for longer, and therefore the dollar has been stronger. And when I talk about the currency effects, when the pound is weaker, it has a beneficial effect for all those big companies in the FTSE 100 who make so much of their earnings overseas. It flatters their earnings, basically.
So, Simon, if we've just had St. George's Day, if people are feeling particularly patriotic and wanting to get involved in UK equities, UK stock market, what's the best way to do it? And should they? I mean, obviously you can't give advice here, Simon, and I would like to caveat that, but, you know.
Yeah.
What's the best way to do it?
Can't give advice, not giving share tips. I should get a tattoo of that. Or just a little sign that I can hold up for all the time.
It's not great for a podcast, though.
The amount of times I get asked the question of, so what should I invest in? What's going to go up? It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, sorry.
I don't know. Also, I mean, look.
Even if you did, you're not qualified.
Don't listen to me, for God's sake. Right. So, like, as an example of this, and as an example of why sensible shoe investing works, I have a portfolio that is way overly skewed towards UK stocks because I have backed this whole UK is cheap, it's a bargain, US is expensive for some time in my ISA. And there is a calculation to be done on how much more money I would have made if I just bought a simple global stock market tracker fund that's got, what, 60, 65% US stocks in it, those expensive stocks that I've been avoiding, how much more I would have made rather than those UK companies I've been backing. But I tell you what, I don't want to do that calculation. I don't want to know the number. I'd be considerably richer is the answer to the question. And I don't want to know what the actual percentage is. So that illustrates why trying to be clever isn't necessarily a good idea. Now, I could get caught out. I could swap it all to a global stock market tracker and the global market sinks and the UK market goes up. And I'd be doubly stuffed. So then you're left in a quandary. But what you've got to remember is that the UK stock market makes up about 4% of the global stock market. So if you have 10% of your investments in the UK stock market, you are heavily overweight the UK, to use investing parlance. Now, that you might be fine with that because you think the UK is cheap. I mean, I do. I'd be perfectly happy to have 10%. But if you've got like 20% or 30%, which like some muggins might do, yourself, me, myself included, then you're really, really overweight the UK. And when the global stock market goes up or the US goes up loads like it did last year, you're going to be sitting there going, well, that's a shame, isn't it? And actually the 1 year that the FTSE 100 managed to outperform its global rivals was 2022. And it did that by just not falling as much, which is not really what you're looking for in outperformance. You're looking for bigger gains, not just not falling as much. I mean, you kind of effectively get the same result from it, but, you know. So if you are going to invest, I would say, firstly, remember that. Remember the bit where you should probably just put your sensible shoes on, invest in the global stock market, or put the bulk of your portfolio into the global stock market. Let the markets do their work for you. Let companies that can go out there use money for productive use to turn profits, do the work for you, and allow the index to decide what should be in and what should be out. Not a fund manager who might get things wrong. But if you do want to go target the UK, you could do it by buying a simple tracker fund. So buy a FTSE All Share tracker. You could buy a FTSE 100 tracker, but you're going a considerably narrower because maybe actually you want exposure to those FTSE 250 companies. Because actually a lot of the share price gains coming off the back of some of these takeovers isn't coming from the FTSE 100 giants, it's coming from stuff further down the level. Or I would go for a fund manager with a really clear strategy and ability to explain what they're doing and why they're doing it. My own personal preference is for investment trusts. But you may find that funds are better for you. And some examples of these kind of investments that I have held or either hold in the past because I've thought that they fitted the bill are Temple Bar Investment Trust. That's very kind of value focused. Nick Train's Finsbury Growth and Income Trust, who I just mentioned. You've got Fidelity Special Values, which again is, you know, very value focused. Or you could look at dividend opportunities where they're targeting the dividends. But again, I would say be careful, because even fund managers who have a very long track record of doing very well can underperform. And take Nick Train, for example, who has ended up, you know, underperforming the market because the very quite limited number of stocks that he holds, the UK companies, the market just doesn't like him at the moment. So, so up.
We are going to continue with investing, because when it comes to building your pension pot or investing for retirement income, where should you be looking? Well, our Tanya has been asking the experts to give their picks of the best investment trust. Tanya, what did you uncover for us?
Okay, well, when you're thinking about investing for retirement, in very broad terms, you've got to think of it in two phases, which the finance industry likes to call accumulation, which is everything up to retirement, and decumulation, which is everything after it. It doesn't fit too neatly, but basically you're looking for growth and then for income in that order, but there's obviously a lot of overlap, and there's definitely an argument that you should maybe still be going for growth in retirement as well, because you still want to get great returns as well as dividends. This look at the best investment trust was actually compiled by their industry body, but they went out to four investing experts and just asked them for their favourite picks for these two broad phases of your investing life. Investing trusts are an interesting one. They're very much favoured, particularly in the income phase, because there's a lot of them which are called dividend heroes, where they raise their dividend every year and have done for the past 50 years. Obviously, they don't want to break that record, so you can be sure that they're going to try their best to keep doing that. So that's one of the reasons that they're popular with certain types of investors. Investment trusts are shares that you buy on the stock market. You buy them and sell them like any other stock you might hold. And that means that they're referred to as a closed-ended investment. They just have the amount of shares that are in issue, as opposed to investment funds, which also people use a lot, and they are pools of investment funds, investors' money. And the reason I say that is that they do have some different characteristics, so you need to be aware of what you're looking at. One of the good things about being a closed-ended investment is that they can smooth out bumps in the road more. And so that's one of the reasons they get to do this trick with dividends in terms of increasing them every year. But they can be more risky investment trusts. And one of the things that you've got to check, along with all the other things that you might check when researching investments, is whether they're trading at a premium or a discount to net asset value. That's just basically the value of everything they hold. And is their share price less than everything they're holding or more than everything they're holding? You need to be aware of that and look into that too. Now, when we come on to the investment trusts that have been picked out by these experts, there's a really broad range. It's split into two phases, as I said. I'll just pick out a couple because you can read the article if you want to look at them all. A financial expert called Philippa Maffioli at Blythe Richmond Investment Managers, she's recommended Worldwide Healthcare Trust, which is an interesting one because you're just looking at one sector there. But I think it's of interest. Obviously, healthcare is a really interesting sector in the growth phase. You've got an aging population worldwide, but also even in the countries which are developing, they are wanting more healthcare, there's more demand for healthcare. And it's an interesting trust because it encompasses everything from big pharma to really exciting, adventurous, unquoted biotech stocks. The ongoing charge is 0.83%. So she recommends that as a good one in the accumulation phase to have a look at. One other from the later phase, although actually Neil Mumford of Milestone Wealth Management says this is actually in his SIP and he's still in the accumulation phase. And he says it can work for either. And it's the Scottish American Investment Company. Obviously, he holds it. So that's a recommendation in itself. He says the yield is 2.9%, but the dividend has been pushed up by 4.2% a year on average over the last 5 years, which he likes. And also, it's seen a lot of capital growth, 170 6% over 10 years. That's got an ongoing charge of 1%. So it's a bit on the high side, but not outrageous, I suppose. So that's just a couple to give you a flavour of the kind of things that were recommended in this article. And it's well worth a look if you're investing for retirement and are looking for some decent ideas.
Just a quick one. You mentioned there about fees. You said high, but not outrageous. What would be considered outrageous? And just highlight again the importance of just taking a note of fees and how much they can eat into your investments.
It's very much a rule of thumb, but most of them, I think, range between about 0.75% and 1%. You can't necessarily say anything hard and fast on it, but maybe
but
some.
Keep an eye, no, surely.
Oh, really. Oh, you yeah. should definitely keep an eye on fees. Yes, absolutely.
Simon?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to keep an eye on fees because whilst under 1% sounds like a really small amount, actually, when you levy that on an investment portfolio, then that's quite a sizable sum. So let's take an example of somebody who's got £100,000 that they've built up in their stocks and shares ISA over the years. If they're paying investment fees of 1% on that on average across all the investments in it over a year, then they're paying £1,000 a year. And if they're paying investment fees of £500, right, that's a 0.5% average. And that £500, that's quite a lot of money, right? You know, £500 is a lot of money when it comes to the difference between paying either X or paying Y for something. And on top of that, you've got to remember that this is a drag on returns over the long term. And as the years roll up and returns compound, then it can make a substantial difference. You know, there's a calculation that shows that basically by shaving about 1% off your fees, if you invest £200 a month over 20 years, it makes about a £10,000 difference to the eventual outcome if you end up with if you have like an average 6% annual return over that period of time. And that's more than a tenth of the eventual pot. So it's quite a big amount. So it's worth watching out for fees on investments. It's also worth watching out for fees on investment platforms because those can vary quite substantially as well. And again, you have to take that into account and how much that eats into your investments. And sometimes, you know, funds have a higher fee and it's worth paying the higher fee because ultimately they're doing, you know, their argument is that the active manager is doing a lot of work and the fund is outperforming and they've got the track record to prove it. But as I said, those track records can change very quickly. But there are also, you know, some funds out there that have had very good performance and have very low fees. If you look, for example, at something like Scottish Mortgage, actively managed, invests all around the world, disruptive companies, one of the most exciting investments you can have out there, down loads over the last couple of years, but before that had gone up lots, very low fees. I think Saints, again, Scottish American Investment Trust has very competitive fees. And if you want to learn more about that one, which Tanya said was interesting, I did an interview with James Dow, the manager of Saints recently, who talked about why he thinks it's important to invest, even if you're investing for income, why it's important to invest for both dividends and growth. And you can find that at thisismoney.co.uk/investing-show.
Right. Thank you, Simon. Meanwhile, Tanya, you have an update. We're going to sticking with pensions here and retirement. You have an update on some of the cases that you've been dealing with relating to state pension top-ups. I think it might even be a new angle that you've been finding out here, Tanya.
It's not entirely new because state pension top-ups are so confusing that a lot of people do fall into the trap of buying the wrong years and so on. Just broadly, though, to catch people up on it, we've been covering for over a year now the problems that Aries have been finding buying state pension top-ups. And the classic case is someone who bought top-ups maybe early last year and is still waiting for either a payment or their forecast to be updated and fears that their money has gone missing and say it's gone into a black hole. Where is it? And we chase it down for them and write stories about it. With my last batch of cases that I sent over, nearly all of them came. One was a classic case like that, but the others came back with these people, it's not going to make a difference to their state pension, and here are the refund details. What seemed to have happened was the payment had actually been processed, and apparently information is automatically sent to the DWP. but it hadn't done anything with the information. And for some, and we're talking about quite a long time, nearly an entire year in one case from last May. The trouble is that these people are chasing payments that they think have gone missing and are going to boost their state pension. But if they're never told that it's not going to make a difference to their state pension and they need to get a refund, then how are they ever going to find out? And if the only way to find out is for me to take cases and ask the press officers at HMRC and the DWP to investigate, that's not going to get people anywhere because I can't take up everyone's cases. It's called apparently called a suspense account. But either way, there is an account of unallocated cash sitting with the government. And a lot of this money might be money that needs to be refunded. It just seems like HMRC is taking in the money and the DWP is calculating the state pensions as a result. That's broadly how it's divided. But between the two of them, no one's saying, hang on, this person is not going to make a difference. We need to at least tip them off that they need to start the application process. Once you do, we've heard anecdotally that it takes about 9 weeks, but obviously we don't know that for sure. The cases that I took, when I realised that they needed refunds, I asked them to make applications immediately, and then I chased them up again and got them through. So they've got their money back in the cases where they wanted to get their money back and not pursue it further. The whole situation with top ups has been very poor and for a long time, and people are understandably very frustrated. And to find out that you went to all this trouble and you've been chasing around, ringing up to find out what's going on, and nobody's told you you need a refund, it's really galling. And people have been making the very valid point that they could have been earning interest on this money that's just been wasted as far as they're concerned. And also, one of the things that I'm going to highlight in this story, which is going to be published today, is the advice is to check with the DWP beforehand. A lot of people check with HMRC as well. But obviously, people have a lot of difficulty doing that. With the cases that I took, they had all made attempts to check it. They all called the DWP, and in some cases, they called HMRC as well. And one case, which is actually a hangover from a previous story, because I'd covered this a case before, they had actually had a letter which spelled out in black and white that they should be paying £5,700. And then after we published the story, they got contacted by HMRC to say, oh, we owe you a £4,600 refund. Now, they had in black and white in a letter what they should pay. And that turned out, obviously, to be completely wrong. And that's a large sum of money to have been tied up. They were obviously, understandably, really upset about that. And they're asking for compensation. They point out that they could be getting 4.25%, which is what they're getting in their joint savings account at the moment. It is definitely causing a lot of further anger when you're not only waiting for something to make a difference to your state pension, but you find out at the end of all this that it's not even going to boost your state pension.
That's it for part one.
I'm now joined for our weekly Investing Explained feature by Alex Webb-Bowen of Charles Stanley Direct. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me.
So we have a reader question for you to answer for us. What are the inheritance tax benefits of a SIP?
So it's a good question. The most important benefit of a SIP is that they are considered outside of the estate from an inheritance tax perspective. So this means that upon death of the account holder, remaining funds can be passed on to beneficiaries free of inheritance tax. It's worth noting that the beneficiaries may have to pay income tax when withdrawing an inherited SIP if the original holder died after the age of 75. But if they died before 75, they can withdraw it tax-free. The beneficiaries also have flexibility over how they withdraw the funds and can either take it as a lump sum, regular income, or transfer the funds into their existing pension arrangements if they wish.
And how do I pass on my SIP?
So you can't leave your pension savings in your will. So the instructions will need to be with your provider. So definitely check with your SIP provider what their rules are on the beneficiary designation. It will usually be via a document called an expression of wish form, and you can continually update these at any time. Any new ones you submit automatically take priority over the previous ones. So speak to your provider, find out from them, and go from there.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Britain's most hated tax is certainly not the Treasury's. Last year, raked in a record £7.5 billion in inheritance tax, according to the latest official figures, the third record annual haul in a row. Meanwhile, the OBR reckons it's only going to keep on going up, hitting a whopping £9.7 billion by 2028-29 tax year. Simon, it's all down to house price growth, is it? Should we all start panicking and planning now?
A big chunk of it is down to house price growth, but there is also the boomer wealth effect kicking in here. Sadly, you know, a sizable number of the people who are now starting to die and pass on inheritances are members of the what's been dubbed the baby boom generation, the post-war generation. And they're leaving behind children and grandchildren who are going to really miss them. And would probably swap any amount of money for them still being alive. But they are also leaving behind a lot of money because this is the generation that benefited from pretty benign economic conditions overall, whilst having to also face pretty tough times throughout it. I mean, we're talking about people who grew up when, you know, potentially rationing was still a thing. And they might not have even had an inside toilet and things like that. And a lot of these people worked very, very hard for their money. Okay. But they also, you know, benefited from high employment, good wages, good pensions in the form of often final salary schemes, good investment returns, good saving returns. They had to deal with very high interest rates, but also substantial gains on properties from house price inflation. So, you know, was it luck? Was it hard work? Was it a combination of the both? Probably a combination of the both. But there's an awful lot of money that is now going to start being left to people. And that's why inheritance tax receipts are rising so quickly. Now, it still only catches about 4% of families in its net, but it's forecast that's going to go up to about 8%. But what's important to remember is that of that 4%, some of them can end up paying bills that run into, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of pounds because inheritance tax above a certain level is 40%. You have the amount that you can each individually give away, like your nil rate band, which is £325,000. You can pass on your unused nil rate band to your surviving spouse, which is a bit unfair on people who didn't get married. And then you have an extra amount of money that you can pass on to your direct descendants, so your children or your grandchildren, if it comes from your own home, your main residence, which takes the tax-free amount up to £1 million. So a lot of married couples with children or grandchildren could give away £1 million tax-free when they die. Over that, it's taxed at 40%. And yeah, the take's going up substantially because it you know, there is such a sizable amount of wealth, particularly in the parts of the country where someone's house might take them over the million anyway, and then everything else on top of it is taxed. But there is also a considerable degree of unfairness going on here. It has been levied because, as I said, some of these people are paying a very large amount. And the effective tax rate, if you look at the official figures from the Office of Tax Simplification, when they did a review into this, highlights how the highest effective tax rate on inheritance tax is paid by those leaving between about £2 and £5 million. And then once you start finding people leaving more than that, the effective tax rate starts to drop nicely because they're the kind of people who can afford to take part in really, you know, quite expensive but quite effective tax planning schemes, things like buying agricultural land that's being farmed and passing it on to people instead.
Isn't it time, though, Simon, that we really did take a look at this situation? Because wasn't the whole point of inheritance tax to hit the really, really wealthy, a bit like the highest rate tax as well, income tax? It's not really becoming that so much anymore. Yes, under 5% of estates currently pay it, but that's obviously going to go up as we continue and bans are frozen and all the like. But you've asked the experts on your website, but you've also asked the true experts. And when I say the true experts, Simon, I mean your readers. You've got a poll on there. They reckon what? What needs to happen with inheritance tax?
Okay, so here we go. Inheritance tax. Right. What would you do about inheritance tax? We have a poll and we've given people a selection of
answers. I've done it, Simon.
I've done it.
Too. I'll tell you why I answered it.
You wanted two answers.
I wanted one answer. I know. I didn't like that.
Choose your favourite answer.
I know. Next time, can we have two?
Okay. Right. All right. So, in total, we have had, just quick maths in head, over 5,000 people vote in this poll. Right?
Right.
So, it's quite a lot. It's not the world's most scientific poll. Okay. It's not going to pass the Ipsos Mori test or whatever it is, but it's pretty good. Raise the threshold 26%. So that is basically allow people to give away more tax free. So, okay.
Yeah. Cuts
the 40% rate. 11%.
I wanted to say that too, but you didn't let me.
Okay. Change the gifting rules. I'll come on to that in a minute. 4%. Abolish it altogether. This is the winner with a whacking 49% of the votes.
Whoa. I missed that.
Yeah. It's fair. Keep it the same. 3%.
Okay.
Wealthiest should pay most. Squeeze them more. 6%. We should have just put eat the rich there. Something else. Brackets. Tell us in the comments. 1%.
Did they tell you in the comments?
Well, yeah, they did.
Yeah.
But most of them just went to the comments and moaned about it and said it should be abolished. So I don't know if they're that 1% or not, but, you know. But look, my personal preference is I think we should just drop the rate to 20%. I don't think we need to raise the allowance. I think £1 million is quite a lot. You know, I think it should be indexed. So it should be at least be going up with inflation, which it hasn't done. I don't think that there should be some of this unfairness about passing on your unused allowance only to your spouse. Wow. Or the direct descendant stuff with your own home. I think basically you should be able to pass on your unused allowance to anybody you want to pass it on to. And I also think you should be able to, if we're going to have this stupid own home allowance, which it would be better if we just got rid of that, right? Because it penalizes renters as well. But if we're going to have that, you should be able to pass on your house to anybody you want to. Like, it shouldn't make any difference whether they remember your family or not, right? But I think we should just cut the rate to 20%, because the problem is 40% sounds like a lot. 40% sounds like a lot because 40% is a lot. If I leave you £100, the government will take 40 pounds of it. That's a lot. You only get left with 60.
You've already probably paid tax, quite a lot of tax on that as you've gone through
and
your
life.
And
this is the argument, double taxation, all this kind of stuff. So I think we should just cut the rate to 20%. But there's a lot of people who disagree, and, you know, a much more popular option was raise the threshold, and an overwhelmingly more popular option was abolish it altogether, which is... never ceases to amaze some people, because, as we said before, only 4% people pay this tax, yet it is regularly trailed as Britain's most hated tax. But this should have been changed ages ago. The Office of Tax Simplification, which Tanya knows more about than me, can explain a little bit more about this. They published a report, a damning report into this years ago, and the government's just sat on its hands and done nothing. I think because what they want to do is do a kind of like vote grabbing, abolish it or raise the threshold massively or slash the rate, but they're not brave enough to do that, so they keep basically like balking at doing it. But it means that we've still got nuts things in there, like the amount you can give away each year before it becomes liable for inheritance tax is £3,000.
Mad.
It's like completely bonkers. You know, you're allowed to give away
weddings are £5,000.
Weddings are £5,000. It's just completely crazy. These allowances haven't gone up in forever. It's like literally, if you buy your 18-year-old child a not particularly expensive second-hand car, right, for £5,000, okay, so that in the grand scheme of things, that's not a huge outlay, and then you have the misfortune for both you and your partner to die the next day, the taxman could come after your child for some of the car.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure you're allowed to just give them some of the car. I think you have to give them some of the money. It's like, here, have the wheels.
Yeah, exactly. We'll take this. Thank you. Tanya, your views on this?
I think the most sensible thing to do would be to sort out the threshold and the unfairness in the threshold. But going back to the political incentives, I don't think that that's going to be exciting enough to say, oh, yes, we're going to sort it out to make the thresholds fair, but they're going to stay at £500,000 for people who own their own home and are leaving property to direct descendants. I'm doubtful on that. The other political incentive goes in the opposite direction, which is I think that they are worried about a giveaway to the rich at a time when we're still really in a cost of living crisis. Inflation might be easing off, but a lot of people are really, really struggling. And we're about to have a pretty contentious election. The Tories might offer something in the manifesto. It's very unclear what Labour will say, maybe nothing at all. But either way, I think you've got to look at the political timing of this as well as what you might actually prefer. I think you've got to look at what's politically doable as well.
And I think that's the problem, isn't it, Tanya, is that there's a load of taxes that we keep writing about where they're just a huge mess and they need sorting out. But the government has dodged sorting them out over the years because A, they make them a nice bit of money and B, politically, they would get a hammering for it, even though everybody knows that the taxes definitely need reform.
Meanwhile, other ways grieving families are being hit financially, probate fees, they're to be hiked 10% to £300. It comes as loved ones are having to wait nearly more than 3 months, actually, on average, for this to be completed after a bereavement. Many, though, are having to wait 6 months or more. Tanya, if you would, what is probate? Why is it so important? And what's going on?
It's a really important stage for some families after they've lost someone in terms of getting control over somebody else's finances. You don't automatically get handed the keys to someone's bank account when they die. Some people don't need probate. If you've got a small estate and there are small sums, then some banks and building societies will accept a valid death certificate. But if you've got an estate where the institutions that you need to access require probate, then you've really got to go through the process. There's been problems with it for quite a long time. There was a big reorganisation a few years ago, and we have covered some stories where I think there was a big loss of the most senior staff. And although they have taken on lots of junior staff, there do seem to be ongoing problems with backlogs. Some years ago, they proposed a sliding scale for fees, which was really controversial. And the row about that went on for several years before eventually it was completely ditched and they stuck with a much lower fee. It's currently a flat £273 and it's going up to £300. But estates that are worth less than £5,000 don't have to pay it. That's the background to it. Any rise is obviously not welcome by people, but the fact that it's come at a time when the probate service itself has been having longer and longer delays. Whenever I do a story about this, I talk to the big inheritance professional bodies and the lawyers. And you usually think of lawyers, accountants and so on. They wouldn't say necessarily they're ruthless, but they're quite hard-nosed. They've seen it all. They get really upset about this. And I think it's because they deal with clients who are grieving and are very emotionally distressed. And the average, I think, is about 3 months at the moment. That's down from about 4 months last autumn. But it can be a lot higher for some cases. If you've got a problem estate, it doesn't have to be a very large one. It just needs to have had a lot of stops put on it. That's what they call it when they put your application on hold. We do get people writing to us who've been waiting over a year, and in some cases, even longer. And that is a really awful amount of time to wait before you can actually start winding up someone's estate. And even if you've got a family who you are not falling out over the inheritance, that's really going to wear on people over time, because some members of the family might not understand why it's taking so long before they get what's due to them. There's all sorts of problems with house sales that it can cause, sales of investments, which might go up or down. And so it can cause a lot of heartache. Usually I speak to lawyers about this, but I have spoken to a few families that have been directly affected over the years. And they're often completely distraught about it.
Is there anything that you, I'm not saying this is people's fault, but is there anything that we could do to make sure that it goes as smoothly as possible, ignoring all the external things going on? Is there anything that we can do? Some tips, Tanya, that we can take control a bit more?
Yes, we've got a guide that's linked to in that current story about the rise, which is at the top of the pensions page at the moment, if people want to go to it. And there is a link to a guide in there, which is how to be an executor, basically. We got a senior lawyer to give some tips, and he's come up with some very useful things on it. I think one of the most useful would be fill the form in yourself, but if you can afford it, go to a lawyer and ask them to look over it to make sure that everything is filled in correctly. You might end up paying their hourly rate, but you might end up just going into their office, sitting there while they go through it and checking everything off. Now, I do actually know someone personally who did this, and even though the average time is, as I say, 3 months, they got it back in about 10 days. And actually, in the latest story, one of the lawyers that we quote does say that it's this point, it's a bit of a lottery, and you do occasionally get people who, where it comes back in 9 or 10 days, and then others where it looks all in order, but it can, you know, take over 6 months. So there's no guarantees, but if you've had a lawyer to go through it, that definitely does help. He also says that you have to pay inheritance tax if it's due, or at least do all the inheritance tax paperwork, even if it's not due, before you get the probate sorted out. Certainly you have to have paid the bill. And he says wait for at least 25 days after submitting your inheritance tax paperwork, because a lot of stops put on because HMRC says, oh, we haven't had this yet. So then it stalls process. And then there's some basic stuff like check all the names are correct. You don't want to misspell someone's name and have the whole thing, you know, delayed for 3 months. And he also says things like if there's one executor that isn't on the application, then explain why they haven't been involved in the application process. So I suppose that's just to head off any questions, and obviously make sure that all the documents are in order, that you've got the original will and so on. If you want to have a closer look at what he says, his tips are all in a nice box at the bottom of that guide that I mentioned.
Fantastic. Thank you, Tanya. And finally, are you a backseat driver? Some of us might not even realise we are. So this is money you've produced, the telltale signs that you are just quite simply a terrible passenger. Tanya, you a backseat driver?
I'm a great passenger.
There we go.
Absolutely stunningly good passenger.
Simon, backseat driver?
I don't think I'm a backseat driver. I'm generally quite happy to just sit there and let things roll along. What I am is I'm a passenger who would generally just rather be driving.
Okay,
I would rather be driving the car than being a passenger, but I don't sit there giving my orders. But anyway, the signs that you might be a backseat driver. Number one, gasping when the driver gets too close to the car in front. Number two, giving directions like left, left. Number three, shouting, watch the cyclist. And not as in because their cycling is really good. I love their cycling. Ordering the driver to slow down, shouting brake, presumably shouting brace, brace would also count as a backseat driver, and doing the airplane brace move, gasping at the slightest braking moment. And here is my favourite piece of backseat driving, the one that even if you're not a backseat driver, everybody has done at some point.
Mm.
Pressing an imaginary brake from the passenger side. That moment when you're like, and your foot goes down as if you're the driver. Complaining about the parking space the driver has chosen, telling the driver to get in the other lane. And then we've got some other stuff, telling the driver to speed up, flinching when they go too close to a parked car, leaning over and turning on the indicator.
Oh, I've done that. Sorry, I was just thinking, oh God, I have done that. Yeah.
Okay, if you've ever leaned over and turned on the driver's indicator, you are a backseat driver. But if you've done the next one, you need to take a long, hard looking at yourself. Leaning over and honking the horn.
Oh, no. I might.
Grabbing the steering wheel. If you're not a driving instructor and you're not teaching someone, don't do that. Unless, obviously, you think there's going to be like a major crash, but you're probably going to cause a crash, so just don't do it anyway. Shouting abuse at the other road users on the driver's behalf.
Of course I've done that.
Telling the driver off for not thanking someone.
Probably done that.
holding
on.
Oh
my God, I'm the backseat driver, a bad one.
Holding onto your seatbelt for dear life. Making rude hand signs to other motorists.
Nah.
And I think this last one is not backseat driving. I think arguably this is, I've been in people's cars where this is totally justified. And on the other hand, also, I've been in cars where the person says that they should be doing this rather than the driver, even though my argument is that the car companies designed the controls in cars so that people driving them can actually use them. Changing the radio station.
Oh, yeah, obviously. Obviously.
Yeah.
I'm in control.
My favourite one is when something bad is going to happen and somebody in the car decides to warn you about it, but by shouting something that has nothing to do with the thing that's going to happen. So you literally have no idea what's
exactly.
wrong. You just know something's wrong.
Exactly. That's should be in the list. But, oh, I'm a terrible person, Simon. That's made me feel bad. Oh, well, never mind. I don't mind. But the radio is mine. Right, that is it. Thank you very much. Fantastic article. I love things like that. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app if you have any comments or questions for the team. If you think you are a backseat driver, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
And anything you'd like to look into does not include your partner's backseat driving, just to be 100% clear. we are not offering that service. You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, put podcast in the subject line, and we do love to hear from you. You can tweet us at thisismoney, come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy, cost effective, and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.